we think about ways to combat climate change, vehicles or power plants that burn fossil fuels might come to mind. But another part of the solution might be under our feet in the soil we use for farming. Our next guest has studied soil and agriculture for years and says that by making some changes, we can keep more carbon in the ground and make farms more productive and profitable in the process. David Montgomery is professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. He's the author of several books, including Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. David, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, as we drive around looking at farmland in Wisconsin, we may not notice a lot of changes over the years, but you've written extensively on the degradation of our soil quality around the world. What kind of changes are we seeing?
Yeah, you know, I'm a geologist, so I'm trained to think about things that happen a little slower than most people notice. But if you look at the back history of agricultural societies around the world, there's really a legacy of land degradation that really comes to the fore in places like Syria and Libya today, where we don't think of them as agricultural powerhouses. But if you go back to Roman times, you know, a couple thousand years ago, there's good tax records of high harvests of wheat off land where the soil's been so degraded now that they have real trouble supporting themselves. And so I wrote about that in a book called Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. Is the first book that I wrote about soil, looking at the problem of land degradation around the world. And there's really two aspects to it. We've eroded topsoil, you know, physically lost it due to accelerated erosion, the removal of soil. And we've also degraded soil organic matter. And organic matter is half carbon. And so we've degraded soil carbon stocks historically as well. And that's had an impact not only on the fertility of the land, but it's also had an impact on the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Let's do that first part first. As we erode our soil and lose carbon in our soil, what does that mean when we're trying to grow crops in that soil?
When if you look at our sort of modern understanding of what makes for soil fertility, there's sort of three really big areas. There's the physics and the chemistry of the soil, you know, the kind of rocks that were broken down to make the soil, the elements that are within it, how water moves through it. But the other part that we almost forgot in the 20th century is the biology of the soil, the microbes, the bacteria and the fungi. And there's organisms in the soil, much like there's organisms in the human gut that we've heard so much about in the last couple of years, that really help in the soil. Plants acquire mineral nutrients. They're involved in the supporting the defensive system of plants. And really the parallels between what goes on in the gut and the root system of plants are pretty astounding. And so carbon is essentially the currency that drives the what I like to call the original underground economy, all that life in the soil that's breaking down the organic matter, getting mineral elements out of the soil, and helping getting them into plants. And why would this life in the soil do that? Because those plants, by producing the organic matter, are making the food that drives the microbes. And so it's there's symbioses, sort of virtuous circles, if you will, where the life in the soil promotes the health and growth of plants, which then through their senescence and decay, when they inevitably die, as all things do, it helps feed the organisms back in the soil and keeps the circle going.
Now let's talk about carbon capture and climate change. A lot of us just think about burning fossil fuels. That's driving the changing carbon composition in our atmosphere. How does soil get into the picture?
Well, you know, if you look back at the sort of how much carbon people have put into the atmosphere over our whole agricultural history, it was only fairly recently that fossil fuels overtook the degradation of soil carbon as a big source of CO2 to the atmosphere. And there's a study done back in 1980 by a guy named Minza Stiver, a gentleman in my department at the University of Washington, who looked at how much of the carbon that had been added to the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution didn't come out of a tailpipe or a factory, but came from plowing up fertile agricultural soil and accelerating the decay of that organic matter, which liberates carbon back to the atmosphere. And what he found was roughly a third of the carbon that had been added to the atmosphere up to about 1980 was from plowing up the Great Plains, plowing up Eastern Europe from agricultural impacts that degraded soil fertility through the loss of soil organic matter. So it's a potentially a pretty big reservoir. The amount of carbon in the world's soils is twice the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. Now, there's a lot of soil in the world, right? And we don't farm all of it. But there's actually potential to put some of that carbon back out of the sky and down into our agricultural soils if we change the way that we farm.
Talking to David Montgomery from the University of Washington. His books include Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. We're talking about agriculture, soil, the food we eat, and climate change. David, let's get into that point now. We can do things differently in a large enough scale to make a difference?
I was pretty impressed when I was doing the research for Growing a Revolution, not only at how much carbon could be put back into agricultural soils, but that it could be done with changes to agricultural practices that were actually more profitable for the farmers. And that's where I started to turn into a real optimist on this issue. Now, you can, like you describe what those practices are, there's sort of a recipe for doing that that I found had worked on farms all around the world in terms of guiding principles for agricultural practices. And they involved not tilling, so doing no-till, but minimally disturbing the soil, keeping the land covered with covered crops. There's always a plant with a living root growing at any one time, whether it's in between one's cash crops or in some of the subsistence farms I visited in Africa, where you have multiple crops all growing at the same time in sort of a polyculture. And the third thing is growing a diversity of plants, which actually helps support that microbial life in the soil that helps support the plant life. And with that combination of things doing, minimal disturbance, the cover crops, and the diversity of crops, it feeds the life in the soil and allows farmers, through restoring their organic matter and rebuilding the fertility of their land, to reduce their reliance on nitrogen fertilizers, to reduce their need for pesticides, and to reduce the amount of tractor trips across the field. If you're not plowing, you're basically not burning as much diesel. And it didn't take that many years, just a couple in most cases, to start the trajectory of soil restoration back to the point where yields came back and recovered to where they were before the transition, and the farming were much more profitable because they were harvesting as much but spending less to actually do it. And that's a recipe not only for a more profitable farm, but for putting carbon back in the ground. And you know, the estimates that you can find in the published literature for how much carbon we could put back into the world's agricultural soils, they're pretty variable. They range from a low of sort of 5 to 10% of our current fossil fuel emissions up to, you know, high, more than 50%. In Growing a Revolution, I tried to look at those kind of estimates, and I came up with thinking that, well, you know, 10 to 20% might be a pretty reasonable estimate globally. So putting reforming farming practices to rebuild the health and fertility of our land is not going to solve the atmospheric carbon problem, but it's a really good down payment on doing so that pays dividends in terms of healthier soils, so less agrochemical use, less off-site farm pollution, higher profitability for particularly for small-scale farms. And there's also questions about whether that would actually lead to growing food that is more nutritious for us when we eat it. And that's the subject of the book that my wife and I are working on now, that hopefully will be done in a year or two. Got a lot of research and work to do on that to try and put the story together.
David, as we wrap up, you mentioned that you've visited a lot of farms that are doing these soil sustainable practices. Is this happening on a large scale, though? Are you seeing huge commodity farms take on some of the practices you mentioned to where it's a scale that we're really going to see a big difference?
Yeah, and that's a great question. That's one of the things that also helped make me optimistic about it is I visited farms in the Dakotas, for example. There were 20,000 acres that had adopted these principles. The ideas behind the minimal disturbance, cover crops, and the diversity of crops, they're scalable. They're the practices that you would use on a really large, industrial commoditized commodity farm are different than the practices you would use, say, on a small-scale vegetable farm growing for an urban farmer's market. You know, the specifics you would use on those farms are really different. The technology, the equipment, all that would be different. But the guiding principles were the same and very effective. And that's where I think that the real promise lies in trying to engage the wonderful curiosity and creativity of our farmers for how they could work these principles into their kinds of practices. So, for example, one commodity farm that I visited in Ohio specialized in growing corn, soybeans, and wheat were the three cash crops that were grown. But they got the diversity and the cover crops in between those rotations. So it actually had restored the organic matter content in the soil there to higher than it was in the native forest before farming ever started in that region. There's a wonderful potential for rebuilding the health and fertility of our land on both organic and conventional farms. The principles work in either context. small scales to large farms. It's sort of a different philosophical way to look at the premise underlying farming practices, but it really requires the engagement and ingenuity and creativity of farmers in different regions to figure out how to apply those principles to their particular crops and setting and technology. So it's an exciting time. We haven't figured out all the answers, but there's an awful lot of potential benefits.
Thanks to David Montgomery for joining us. He's a professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. His books include Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. He talked with us about how changing the way we manage our farm soil, tilling less and keeping more carbon in the ground, for example, could help our crops, help our farms be more productive, and be one step in combating climate change. If you're already doing this, if you're a farmer who's using, say, no-till or low-till methods of farming, love to hear from you. How's it working for you? Email ideas@WPR.org.